Chapter 4. The Shed. 1. It was August 14th. A quick calculation told Gardner that he had been with Bobby for 41 days, almost exactly a biblical period of confusion or unknown time, as in, he wandered in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. It seemed longer. It seemed like his entire life. He and Bobby did no more than pick at the frozen pizza Gardner heated up for their supper. "I think I'd like a beer," Bobby said, going to the fridge. "How about you? Want one, Gard?" "I'll pass, thanks." Bobby raised her eyebrows but said nothing. She got the beer, walked out on the porch, and Gardner heard the seat of her old rocker creak comfortably as she sat down. After a while, he drew a cold glass of water from the tap, went out, and sat beside Bobby. They sat there for what seemed a long time, not speaking, just looking out into the hazy stillness of early evening. "Been a long time, Bobby. You and me," he said. "Yes, a long time. And a strange ending." "Is that what it is?" Gardner asked, turning in his chair to look at Bobby. "The end?" Bobby shrugged easily. Her eyes slid away from Gardner's. "Well, you know. End of a phase. How's that? Any better?" "If it's le mot juste, then it's not just better, not even the best. Just the only mot that matters. Isn't that what I taught you?" Bobby laughed. "Yeah, it was. First damn class. Mad dogs, Englishmen, and English teachers. Yeah. Yeah." Bobby sipped her beer and looked out at the old dairy road again. Impatient for them to arrive, Gardner supposed. If the two of them had really said everything there was left to say after all these years, he almost wished he had never heeded the impulse to come back at all, no matter what the reasons or eventual outcome. Such a weak ending to a relationship which had, in its time, encompassed love, sex, friendship, a period of tense détente, concern, and even fear, seemed to make mock of the whole thing, the pain, the hurt, the effort. "I always loved you, Gard," Bobby said softly and thoughtfully, not looking at him. "And no matter how this turns out, remember that I still do." Now she did look at Gardner, her face a strange parody of a face under the thick makeup. Surely this was some hopeless eccentric who happened to resemble Bobby a little. "And I hope you'll remember that I never asked to stumble over the goddamn thing. Free will was not a factor here, as some wise-ass or other has surely said." "But you chose to dig it up," Gardner said. His voice was as soft as Bobby's, but he felt a new terror steal into his heart. Was that crack about free will a roundabout apology for his own impending murder? "Stop it, Gard. Stop jumping at shadows. Is the car buried out at the end of Nister Road a shadow?" his mind returned at once. Bobby laughed softly. "Man, the idea that whether or not to dig something like that up could ever be a function of free will. You might be able to stick that to a kid in a high school debate, but we out on the poach, God. You don't really think a person chooses something like that, do you? Do you think people can choose to put away any knowledge once they've seen the edge of it?" "I've been picketing nuclear power plants on that assumption, yes," Gardner said slowly. Bobby waved it away. "Societies may choose not to implement ideas. Actually, I doubt even that, but for the sake of argument, we'll say it so. But ordinary people? No, Gard, I'm sorry. When ordinary people see something sticking out of the ground, they got to dig on it. They got to dig on it. Because it might be treasure." "And you didn't have the slightest inkling that there would be..." Fallout was the word that came to mind. He didn't think it was a word Bobby would like. "Consequences?" Bobby smiled openly. "Not a hint in the world." "But Peter didn't like it.
No, Peter didn't like it. But it didn't kill him, guard.
I'm quite sure it didn't.
Peter died of natural causes. He was old. That thing in the woods is a ship from another world. Not Pandora's box. Not a divine apple tree. I heard no voice from heaven singing, "Of this ship shalt thou not eat, lest ye die."
Guard smiled a little. But it is a ship of knowledge, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose.
Bobby was looking toward the road again, obviously not wanting to pursue the topic further. When do you expect them? Gardner asked. Instead of answering, Bobby nodded at the road. Kyle Archenborg's caddy was coming, followed by Adley McKean's old Ford.
Guess I'll go inside and catch some winks, Gardner said, getting up.
If you want to go out to the ship with us, you're welcome to.
With you, maybe. With them? He cocked a thumb toward the approaching cars. They think I'm crazy. Also, they hate my guts because they can't read my mind.
If I say you go, you go.
Well, I think I'll pass, Gardner said, getting up and stretching. I don't like them either. They make me nervous.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. Just tomorrow. The two of us, Bobby. Right?
Right.
Give them my best, and remind them I helped, steel plate in my head or not.
I will, of course I will.
But Bobby's eyes slid away again, and Gardner didn't like that. He didn't like it at all. 2. He thought they might go in the shed first, but they didn't. They stood around outside for a while talking, Bobby, Frank, Newt, Dick Allison, Hazel, the others, and then moved off toward the woods in a tight group. The light was shading down toward purple now, and most of them were carrying flashlights. Watching, Guard felt that his last real moment with Bobby had come and gone. There was nothing now but to go into the shed and see what was in there. Make up his mind once and for all. Saw an eyeball peeping through a smoky cloud behind the green door. He got up and went through the house to the kitchen in time to see them heading into Bobby's rampant garden. He counted noses quickly, making sure that they were all there, then headed for the cellar. Bobby kept a spare key ring down there. He opened the cellar door and paused one final time.
Do you really want to do this?
No. No, he did not. But he meant to do it. And he discovered that, more than fear, he felt a great sense of loneliness. There was literally no one else he could turn to for help. He had been in the desert with Bobby Anderson 40 days and 40 nights, and now he was in the desert on his own. God help him. To hell with it, he thought. Like the old World War I platoon sergeant was supposed to have said, "Come on, you guys, you want to live forever?" Gardner went downstairs to get Bobby's keyring. 3. It was there, hanging on its nail with every key neatly labeled. The only catch was the shed key was gone. It had been here. He was quite sure of that. When had he last seen it here? Guard tried to remember and couldn't. Bobby taking precautions? Maybe. He stood in the new and improved workshop, sweat on his forehead and sweat on his balls. No key. That was great. So what was he supposed to do? Grab Bobby's axe and make like Jack Nicholson in The Shining? He could see it. Smash, crash, bash. Here's Gardner. Except that might be a bit hard to cover up before the pilgrims came back from the viewing of the sacred hatch. He stood in Bobby's workshop, feeling time slip away, feeling old and unimproved. How long would they be out there anyway? No way of telling, was there? No way at all. Okay, where do people put keys? Always assuming she really was just taking precautions and not just hiding it from you. A thought struck him so hard he actually slapped his forehead. Bobby hadn't taken the key, nor had anyone been trying to hide it.
The key had disappeared when Bobby had supposedly been in the Dairy Home Hospital recovering from sunstroke. He was almost positive of that, and what memory would not or could not supply, logic did. Bobby hadn't been in Dairy Home, she had been in the shed. Had one of the others taken the spare key to tend her when Bobby needed tending? Did they all have copies? Why bother? No one in Haven was into stealing these days. They were into becoming. The only reason the shed was kept locked was to keep him out. So they could just... Gardner remembered watching them arrive on one of the occasions after the something had happened to Bobby. The something that had been a lot more serious than heat prostration. He closed his eyes and saw the caddy. Kyle won. They get out and... And Archambault splits off from the rest for a moment or two. You're up on one elbow, looking out the window at them. And if you think of it at all, you think he must have stepped around there to tap a kidney. But he didn't. He went around to get the key. Sure, that's what he did, went around to get the key. It wasn't much, but it was enough to get him moving. He ran back up the cellar stairs, headed for the door, then doubled back. In the bathroom, there was an ancient pair of Foster Grant's sunglasses on top of the medicine cabinet. They had come to rest up there with a finality that trivial objects managed to obtain only in a single man or woman's quarters, like the makeup which had belonged to Newt Beringer's wife. Gardner took the sunglasses down, blew a thick coating of dust from the lenses, wiped them carefully, then folded the bows and put them in his breast pocket. He went out to the shed. 4. He stood by the padlocked plank door for a moment, looking out along the path which led to the dig. Dusk had advanced far enough now so that the woods beyond the garden were a massy blue-gray with no detail to them. He saw no bobbing line of returning flashlights. But they could turn up. At any time at all, they could turn up and catch you with your arm all the way down in the jam jar. I think they'll spend a pretty good while out there mooning over it. They've got the Klieg lights. But you don't know for sure. No, not for sure. Gardner shifted his gaze back to the plank door. Between the planks, he could see that green light, and he could hear a dim, unpleasant noise, like an old-fashioned washing machine, with a gut full of clothes and thick suds. No, not just one washing machine, more like a whole line of them, not quite in sync. That light was pulsing in time to the low, slurping sound. I don't want to go in there. There was a smell. Even that, Gardner thought, was slightly sudsy, bland, with a faint hint of rancidity. Old soap, cakey soap. But it's no bunch of washing machines. That sounds alive. It's not telepathic typewriters inside there, not new and improved water heaters. It's something alive. And I don't want to go in there. But he was going to. After all, hadn't he come back from the dead just to look inside Bobby's shed and catch the Tommyknockers at their strange little benches? He supposed he had. Guard went around to the far side of the shed. There, hanging on a rusty nail under the eave, was the key. He reached up with a hand that trembled and took it down. He tried to swallow. At first he couldn't. His throat felt as if it had been coated with dry, heated flannel. A drink, just one drink. I'll go into the house long enough to get just one, a short peg, then I'll be ready. Fine, sounded great. Except he wasn't going to do it, and he knew he wasn't. The drinking part was done. So was the delaying part. Holding the key tightly in his damp hand, Gardner went around to the door. He thought, don't want to go in. Don't even know if I can, because I am so afraid. Stop it. Let that part be over, too. Your Tommyknocker phase. He looked around again, almost hoping to see the line of flashlights coming out of the woods or to hear their voices. But you wouldn't, because they talk in their heads. No flashlights, no movements, no crickets, no birdsong. The only sound was the sound of washing machines, the sound of amplified, leaky heartbeats. Slish, slish, slish. Gardner looked at the pulsing green light fingering its way through the cracks between the boards. He reached into his pocket, took out the old sunglasses, and put them on. It had been a long time since he had prayed, but he prayed now. It was short, but a prayer for all that. "God, please," Jim Gardner said into the dim summer dusk, and slid the key into the padlock. 5. He expected a blast of head radio, but none came. Until it didn't, he hadn't realized that his stomach was tight and sucked in, like a man expecting an electric shock. He licked his lips and turned the key. A small noise, barely audible over the low slouching noises from the shed. Click. The hasp sprang up a little from the body of the lock. He reached for it with an arm that felt like lead. He pulled it free, clicked the hasp down, and put it into his left front pocket with the key still sticking out. He felt like a man in a dream. It was not a good one to be having. The air in there had to be okay. Well, perhaps not okay. Perhaps none of the air in Haven was exactly okay anymore. But it was about the same as the air outside, Gard thought, because the shed was a sieve of cracks. If there was such a thing as a pure Tommyknocker biosphere, this couldn't be it. At least he didn't think so. All the same, he would take as few risks as possible. He took a deep breath, held it, and told himself to count his steps. 3. You go in no more than 3 steps, just in case. 1 good look around and then out, in 1 big hurry. You hope? Yes, I hope. He took a final look along the path, saw nothing, turned back to the shed, and opened the door. The green glow, brilliant even through the dark glasses, washed over him like corrupt sunlight. 6. At first, he could see nothing at all. The light was too bright. He knew it had been brighter than this on other occasions, but he had never been so close to it before. Close? God, he was in it. Someone standing just outside the open door looking for him now would hardly be able to see him. He slitted his eyes against that brilliant greenness and shuffled forward a step, then another step, then a third. His hands were held out in front of him like those of a groping blind man, which he was. Shit, he even had the dark glasses to prove it. The noise was louder. Slish, slish, slish. Off to the left. He turned in that direction, but didn't go any further. He was afraid to go any further, afraid of what he might touch. Now his eyes began to adjust. He saw dark shapes in the green. A bench. But no Tommyknockers at it. It had simply been shoved back against the wall, out of the way, and... My God! It is a washing machine! It really is! It was all right. One of the old-fashioned kind with wringer roller at the top, but it wasn't making that weird noise. It had also been pushed back against the wall. It was in the process of being modified somehow. Someone was working on it in the best Tommyknocker tradition, but it wasn't running now. Next to it was an Electrolux vacuum cleaner, one of the old long ones that ran on wheels, low to the ground like a mechanical dachshund. A chainsaw mounted on wheels. Stacks of smoke detectors from Radio Shack, most still in their boxes. A number of kerosene drums, also on wheels, with hoses attached to them, and things like arms. Arms, of course they are. They're robots, fucking robots in the making. And none of them looks exactly like the White Dove of Peace, does it, Guard? And slish, slish, slish. Further left. The source of the glow was here. Guard heard a funny, hurt noise escape him. The breath he had been holding ran weakly out like air from a pricked balloon. The strength ran out of his legs in exactly the same way. He reached out blindly. His hand found the bench, and he did not sit but simply plopped down on it. He was unable to take his eyes from the left rear corner of the shed, where Ev Hillman, Ann Anderson, and Bobby's good old beagle Peter had somehow been hung up on posts in two old galvanized steel shower cabinets with their doors removed. They hung there, like slabs of beef on meat hooks. But they were alive, Gard saw, somehow, some way, still alive. A thick black cord, which looked like a high-voltage line or a very big coaxial cable, ran out of the center of Ann Anderson's forehead. A similar cable ran out of the old man's right eye, and the entire top of the dog's skull had been peeled away. Dozens of smaller cords ran out of Peter's exposed and pulsing brain. Peter's eyes, free of cataracts, turned toward Gard. He whined. "Jesus! Oh, my Jesus! Oh, my Jesus Christ!" He tried to get up from the bench. He couldn't. Portions of the old man's skull and Anne's skull had also been removed, he saw. The doors had been torn off the shower stalls, but they were still full of some clear liquid. It was being contained in the same way that Tiny Sun was contained in Bobby's water heater, he supposed. If he tried to get into one of those stalls, he would feel a tough springiness, plenty of give, but no access. "Want to get in? I only want to get out." Then his mind returned to its former scripture. "Jesus, dear Jesus, oh my Jesus, look at them." "I don't want to look at them." "No," but he couldn't tear his eyes away. The liquid was clear, but emerald green. It was moving, making that low, thick, sudsy sound. For all its clarity, Gardner thought that the liquid must be very gluey indeed, perhaps the consistency of dish detergent. "How can they breathe in there? How can they be alive? Maybe they're not. Maybe it's only the movement of the liquid that makes you think they are. Maybe it's just an illusion. Please, Jesus, let it be an illusion." "Peter, you heard him whine." "Nope. Part of the illusion, that's all. He's hanging on a hook in a shower stall filled with the interstellar equivalent of Joy dish detergent. He couldn't whine in that. It would come out all soap bubbles. And you're just freaking out. That's what it is. Just a little visit from King Freakout." Except he wasn't just freaking, and he knew it. Just as he knew he hadn't heard Peter whine with his ears. That hurt, helpless whining sound had come from the same place the radio music came from, the center of his brain. Ann Anderson opened her eyes. "Get me out of here," she screamed. "Get me out of here. I'll leave her alone. Only I can't feel anything except when they make it hurt, make it hurt, make it hurt." Gardner tried again to get up. He was very faintly aware that he was making a sound, just some old sound. The sound he was making was probably a lot like the sound a woodchuck run over in the road might make, he thought. The greenish, moving liquid gave Sissy's face a gassy, ghastly corpse hue. The blue of her eyes had bleached out. Her tongue floated like some fleshy undersea plant. Her fingers, wrinkled and pruny, drifted. "I can't feel anything except when they make it hurt," Anne wailed. And he couldn't shut her voice out, couldn't stick his fingers in his ears to make it go away, because that voice was coming from inside his head. Slish, slish, slish. Copper tubing running into the tops of the shower stalls, making them look like a hilarious combination of Buck Rogers suspended animation chambers and Lil Abner moonshine stills. Peter's fur had fallen out in patches. His hindquarters appeared to be collapsing in on themselves. His legs moved through the liquid in long, lazy sweeps, as if in his dreams he was running away. "When they make it hurt." The old man opened his one eye. "The boy." This thought was utterly clear, unquestionable. Gardner found himself responding to it. "What boy?" The answer was immediate, startling for a moment, then unquestionable. "David. David Brown." That one eye stared at him, a ceaseless sapphire with emerald tints. Save the boy. The boy, David, David Brown. Was he a part of this somehow? The boy they had hunted for so many exhausting hot days? Of course he was. Maybe not directly, but a part of it. Where is he? Gardner thought at the old man, who floated in his pale green solution. Slish, slish, slish. Altair 4, the old man returned finally. David's on Altair 4. Save him. And then kill us. This is... It's bad. Real bad. Can't die. I've tried. We all have. Even... Bitch, bitch. Her. This is being in hell. Use the transformer to save David. Then pull the plugs, cut the wires, burn the place. Do you hear? For the third time, Gardner tried to get up and fell bonelessly back onto the bench. He became aware that thick electrical cords were scattered all over the floor, and that brought back a ghostly memory of the band that had picked him up on the turnpike when he was coming back from New Hampshire. He puzzled at this, and then got the connection. The floor looked like a concert stage just before a rock group started to play. That or a big city TV studio. The cables snaked into a huge crate filled with circuit boards and a stack of VCRs. They were wired together. He looked for a DC current converter, saw none, and then thought, of course not, idiot. Batteries are DC. The cassette recorders had been plugged into a mix of home computers. Ataris, Apple IIs and IIIs, TRS-80s, Commodores. Blinking on and off on the one lit screen was the word, Program? Behind the modified computers were more circuit boards, hundreds of them. The whole thing was uttering a low, sleepy hum, a sound he associated with, use the transformer, big electrical equipment. Light spilled out of the crate and the computers placed haphazardly next to it in a green flood. But the light was not quite steady. It was cycling. The pulse of the light and its relation to the sudsing sounds coming from the shower cabinets was very clear. That's the center, he thought with an invalid's weak excitement. That's the annex to the ship. They come in the shed to use that. It's a transformer, and they draw their power from there. Use the transformer to save David. Might as well ask me to fly Air Force One. Ask me something easy, Pop. If I could bring him back from wherever he was by reciting Mark Twain, Poe even, I'd take a shot. But that thing, it looks like an explosion in an electronics warehouse. But the boy. How old? 4? 5? And where in God's name had they put him? The sky was, literally, the limit. Save the boy. Use the transformer. There was, of course, not even any time to look closely at the damned mess. The others would be coming back. Still, he stared at the one lighted video terminal with hypnotic intensity. Program? What if I typed Altair 4 on the keyboard, he wondered, and saw there was no keyboard. At the same second, the letters on the screen changed. Altair 4, it now read. No! His mind screamed, full of intruder's guilt. No, Jesus, no! The letters rippled. No, Jesus, no! Sweating, Gardner thought, cancel, cancel. Cancel, cancel. These letters blinked on and off, on and off. Gardner stared at them, horrified. Then, program? He made an effort to shield his thoughts and tried again to get to his feet. This time he made it. Other wires came out of the transformer. These were thinner. There were, he counted, yes, 8 of them, ending in earplugs. Earplugs. Freeman Moss, the animal trainer leading mechanical elephants. Here were more earplugs. In a crazy way, it reminded him of a high school language lab. Are they learning another language in here? Yes. No. They're learning to become. The machine is teaching them. But where are the batteries? I don't see any. There should be 10 or 12 big old Delcos hooked up to that thing. Just a maintenance charge running through it. There should be...
Stunned, he raised his eyes to the shower stalls again. He looked at the coaxial cable coming out of the woman's forehead, the old man's eye. He watched Peter's legs moving in those big, dreamy strides, and wondered just how Bobby had gotten the dog hairs on her dress. Had she been giving Peter the equivalent of an interstellar oil change? Had she perhaps been overcome by a simple human emotion? Love? Remorse? Guilt? Had she perhaps hugged her dog before filling that cabinet up with liquid again? There are the batteries. Organic Delcos and Everettis, you might say. They're sucking them dry. Sucking them like vampires. A new emotion crept through his fear and bewilderment and revulsion. It was fury, and Gardner welcomed it. They make it hurt. Make it hurt. Make it hurt. Her voice cut off abruptly. The dull hum of the transformer changed pitch, cycled down even lower. The light coming out of the crate faded a little. He thought she had fallen unconscious, thereby lowering the machine's total output by X number of... what? Volts? Dynes? Ohms? Who the fuck knew? End it, son. Save my grandson, and then end it. For a moment the old man's voice filled his head, perfectly clear and perfectly lucid. Then it was gone. The old man's eye slipped closed. The green light from the machine grew paler yet. They woke up when I came in, he thought feverishly. The anger still pounded and drilled at his mind. He spat out a tooth almost without realizing he had done so. Even Peter woke up a little. Now they've gone back to whatever state they were in before. Sleeping? No, not sleeping. Something else. Organic cold storage. Do batteries dream of electric sheep? He thought, and uttered a cracked cackle. He moved backward, away from the transformer. What exactly is it transforming? How? Why? Away from the shower stalls, the cables. His eyes turned toward the array of gadgets ranged against the far wall. The wringer washer had something mounted on top of it, something that looked like the boomerang TV antennas you sometimes saw on the backs of big limos. Behind the washer and to its left was an old-fashioned treadle sewing machine with a glass funnel mounted on its side wheel, kerosene drums with hoses and steel arms. A butcher knife, he saw, had been welded to the end of one of those arms. Christ, what is all this? What is it for? A voice whispered, maybe it's protection guard, in case the Dallas police show up early. It's the Tommyknocker Yard Sale Army. Old washing machines with cellular antennas, Electrolux vacuums, chainsaws on wheels. Name it and claim it, baby. He felt his sanity tottering. His eyes were drawn relentlessly back to Peter. Peter, with most of his skull peeled away. Peter, with a bunch of wires plugged into what remained of his head. His brain looked like a pallid veal roast with a bunch of temperature probes stuck into it. Peter, with his legs racing dreamily through that liquid, as if running away. Bobby, he thought in despair and fury. How could you do it to Peter? Christ! The people were bad, awful, but Peter was somehow worse. It was a curse piled on top of an obscenity. Peter, his legs loping and loping as if running away in his dreams. Batteries. Living batteries. He backed into something. There was a dull metallic thump. He turned around and saw another shower cabinet. Little blossoms of rust on its sides, its front door gone. Holes had been punched in the back. Wires had been threaded through these. They now hung limply down. Large bore steel plugs at their tips. For you, guard, his brain yammered,
This plug's for you, like the beer commercials say. They'll open up the back of your skull, maybe short out your motor control centers first, so you can't move, and then they'll drill. Drill for the place where they get their power. This plug's for you, for all you do. All ready and waiting. Wow, neato, keno.
He snatched for his thoughts, which were tightening into a hysterical spiral, and brought them under control.
Not for him. At least not originally. This had already been used.
There was that faint smell, bland and sudsy. Streaks of dried gunk on the inner walls, the last traces of that thick green liquid.
Looks like the Wizard of Oz's semen, he thought.
Do you mean Bobby's got her sister floating in a big sperm bank?
That weird cackle escaped him again.
He pressed the heel of his hand against his mouth, pressed hard to stifle it. He looked down and saw a pair of tan shoes tossed beside the shower cabinet. He picked one up, saw splashes of dried blood on it.
Bobby's.
Her one pair of good shoes. Her going-out shoes. She was wearing them when she left for the funeral that day.
The other shoe was also bloody.
Guard looked behind the shower cabinet and saw the rest of the clothing Bobby had been wearing that day.
The blood. All that blood.
He didn't want to touch the blouse, but the shape under it was too clear. He pinched as small a piece of it as he could between his fingers and peeled it up from Bobby's good charcoal-colored skirt. Underneath the skirt was a gun. It was the biggest, oldest-looking gun Gardner had ever seen except for pictures in a book. After a moment, he picked the gun up and rolled the cylinder. There were still four rounds in it, two gone. Gardner was willing to bet that one of those rounds had gone into Bobby. He pushed the cylinder back into place and stuck it in his belt. At once, a voice spoke up in his mind.
Shot your wife. Good fucking deal.
Never mind. The gun might come in handy.
When they see it's gone, it's you they'll come looking for, guard. I thought you already came to that conclusion.
No, that was one thing he didn't think he had to worry about. They would have noticed the changed words on the computer screen. But these clothes hadn't been touched since Bobby took them off, or since they took them off her, which was probably more likely.
They must be too exalted when they get in here to bother much about housekeeping, he thought. Damn good thing there's no flies. He touched the gun again. This time the voice in his head was silent. It had decided, perhaps, that there were no wives here to worry about.
If you have to shoot Bobby, will you be able to?
That was a question he couldn't answer.
Slish, slish, slish.
How long had Bobby and her company been gone? He didn't know, hadn't the slightest idea. Time had no meaning in here. The old man was right. This was hell. And did Peter still respond to his strange master's caress when she came in here? His stomach was on the edge of revolt. He had to get out right now. He felt like a creature in a fairy tale, Bluebeard's wife in the secret room, Jack grubbing in the giant's pile of gold. He felt ripe for discovery, but he held the stiff, bloody garment in front of him as if frozen. Not as if, he was frozen.
Where's Bobby?
She had a sunstroke.
Hell of a strange sunstroke that had soaked her blouse with blood.
Gardner had retained a morbid, sickish interest in guns and the damage they could do to the human body. If she had been shot with the big old gun now in his own belt, he guessed Bobby had no right to be alive. Even if she had been taken quickly to a hospital which specialized in the emergency treatment of gunshot wounds, she probably would have died.
They brought me in here when I was blown apart, but the Tommyknockers fixed me up right smart.
Not for him. The old shower stall was not for him. Gardner had a feeling that he would be put out of the way with more finality. The shower stall had been for Bobby. They had brought her in here and...
What?
Why, hooked her up to their batteries, of course. Not Anne, she had not been here then, but to Peter.
And Hillman.
He dropped the blouse, then forced himself to pick it up again and put it back on top of the skirt.
He didn't know how much of the real world they noticed when they got in here. Not much, he guessed, but he didn't want to take any extra chances. He looked at the holes in the back of the cabinet, the dangling cords with the steel plugs at their tips. The green light had begun to pulse brighter and more rapidly again. He turned around. Anne's eyes were open again. Her short hair floated around her head. He could still see that unending hate in her eyes, now mixed with horror and growing strangeness. Now there were bubbles. They floated up from her mouth in a brief, thick stream. Thought sound exploded in his head. She was screaming. Gardner fled. 7. Real terror is the most physically debilitating of all emotions. It saps the endocrines, dumps muscle-tightening organic drugs into the bloodstream, races the heart, exhausts the mind. Jim Gardner staggered away from Bobby Anderson's shed on rubber legs, his eyes bugging, his mouth hanging stupidly open, the tongue lolled in one corner like a dead thing, his bowels hot and full, his stomach cramped. It was hard to think beyond the crude, powerful images which stuttered on and off in his mind like barroom neon. Those bodies, hung up on hooks, like bugs impaled on pins by cruel, bored children. Peter's relentlessly moving legs. The bloody blouse with the bullet hole in it. The plugs. The old-fashioned washing machine topped with the boomerang antenna. Strongest of all was the image of that short, thick stream of bubbles emerging from Anne Anderson's mouth as she screamed inside his head. He got into the house, rushed into the bathroom, and knelt in front of the toilet bowl, only to discover he couldn't puke. He wanted to puke. He thought of maggoty hot dogs, moldy pizza, pink lemonade with hairballs floating in it. Finally, he rammed two fingers down his throat. He was able to trip a simple gag reaction by this last, but no more. He couldn't sick it up. Simple as that. If I can't, I'll go crazy. Fine, go crazy if you have to, but first do what you have to do. Keep it together that long. And just by the way, guard, do you have any more questions about what you should do? Not anymore, he didn't. Peter's relentlessly moving legs had convinced him. That stream of bubbles had convinced him. He wondered how he could have hesitated so long in the face of a power that was so obviously corrupting, so obviously dark. "Because you were mad," he answered himself. Guard nodded. That was it. No more explanation was needed. He had been mad. And not just for the last month or so. It was late to wake up. Oh, yes, very late. But late was better than never. The sound. Slish, slish, slish. The smell. Bland, yet meaty. A smell his mind insisted on associating with raw veal slowly spoiling in milk. His stomach lurched. A burning, acidic burp scorched his throat. Gardner moaned. The idea, that glimmer, returned to him, and he clutched at it. It might be possible, either to abort all of this, or at least to put it on hold for a long, long time. It just might. You got to let the world go to hell in its own way, guard, 2 minutes to midnight or not. He thought of Ted, the power man, again, thought of mad military organizations trading ever more sophisticated weapons with each other, and that angry, inarticulate, obsessed part of his mind tried to shout down sanity one final time. Shut up, Gardner told it. He went into the guest bedroom and pulled off his shirt. He looked out the window, and now he could see sparks of light coming out of the woods. Dark had come. They were returning. They would go into the shed and maybe have a little seance, a meeting of minds around the shower cabinets, fellowship in the homey green glow of raped minds. Enjoy it, Gardner thought. He put the .45 under the foot of the mattress, then unbuckled his belt. It may be the last time, so... He looked down at his shirt. Sticking out of the pocket was a bow of metal. It was the padlock, of course, the padlock which belonged on the shed door.
8.
For a moment, which probably seemed much longer than it actually was, Gardner was unable to move at all. That feeling of unreal fairy tale terror stole back into his tired heart. He was reduced to a horrified spectator watching those lights move steadily along the path. Soon they would reach the overgrown garden. They would cut through. They would cross the dooryard. They would reach the shed. They would see the missing padlock. Then they would come into the house and either kill Jim Gardner or send his discorporated atoms to Altair 4, wherever that was. His first coherent thought was simple panic, yelling at the top of his voice, "Run! Get out of here!" His second thought was the shaky resurfacing of reason. Guard your thoughts. If you ever guarded them before, guard them now. He stood with his shirt off, his unbuckled and unzipped jeans sagging around his hips, staring at the padlock in his shirt pocket. Get out there right now and put it back right now! No, no time. Christ, there's no time. They're at the garden. There might be. There might be just enough if you quit playing pocket pool and get moving. He broke the paralysis with a final harsh effort of will, bent, snatched up the lock with the key still sticking out of the bottom, and ran, zipping his pants as he went. He slipped out the back door, paused for just a moment as the last two flashlights slipped into the garden and disappeared, then ran for the shed. Faintly, vaguely, he could hear their voices in his mind, full of awe, wonder, jubilation. He closed them out. Green light fanning out from the shed door, which stood ajar. Christ, guard, how could you have been so stupid? His cornered mind raved. But he knew how. It was easy to forget such mundane things as relocking doors when you had seen a couple of people hung up on posts with coaxial cables coming out of their heads. He could hear them in the garden now, could hear the rustle of the useless giant corn stalks. As he reached toward the hasp, lock in hand, he remembered closing it before dropping it into his pocket. His hand jerked at the thought, and he dropped the goddamn thing. It thumped to the ground. He looked for it, and at first couldn't see it at all. No, there it was. There, just beyond the narrow fan of pulsing green light. There was the lock, yes. But the key wasn't in it anymore. The key had fallen out when the lock thumped to the ground. God, my God, my God, his mind sobbed. His body was now covered with oozing sweat. His hair hung in his eyes. He thought he must smell like a rancid monkey. He could hear cornstalks and leaves rustling louder. Someone laughed quietly. The sound was shockingly near. They would be out of the garden in seconds. He could feel those seconds bustling by like self-important businessmen with pot bellies and attaché cases. He went down on his knees, snatched up the lock, and began to sweep his hand back and forth in the dirt, trying to find the key. Oh, you bastard, where are you? Oh, you bastard, where are you? Oh, you bastard, where are you? Aware that even now, in his panic, he had thrown a screen around his thoughts. Was it working? He didn't know, and if he couldn't find the key, it didn't matter, did it? Oh, you bastard, where are you? He saw a dull glint of silver beyond where he was sweeping his hand. The key had gone much further than he would have believed. His seeing it was only dumb luck, like Bobby stumbling over that little rim of protruding metal in the earth 2 months before, he supposed. Gardner snatched it and bolted to his feet. He would be hidden from them by the angle of the house for just a moment longer, but that was all he had left. One more screw-up, even a little one, would finish him, and there might not be enough time left even if he performed each of the mundane little operations involved in padlocking a door perfectly. The fate of the world may now depend on whether a man can lock a shed door on the first try, he thought dazedly. Modern life is so challenging. For a moment, he didn't think he was even going to be able to slot the key in the lock. It chattered all the way around the slit without going in, a prisoner of his shaking hand. Then, when he thought it really was all over, it slid home. He turned it, the lock opened. He closed the door, slipped the arm of the padlock through the hasp, and then clicked it shut. He pulled the key out and folded it into his sweating hand. He slid around the corner of the shed like oil. At the exact moment he did, the men and women who had gone out to the ship emerged into the dooryard, moving in single file. Gardner reached up to hang the key on the nail where he had found it. For one nightmare moment, he thought he was going to drop it again and have to hunt for it in the high weeds growing on this side of the shed. When it slipped onto the nail, he let out his breath in a shuddering sigh. Part of him wanted not to move, to just freeze here. Then he decided he'd better not take the risk. After all, he didn't know that Bobby had her key. He continued slipping along the side of the shed. His left ankle struck the haft of an old harrow that had been left to rust in the weeds, and he had to clamp his teeth over a cry of pain. He stepped over it and slipped around another corner. Now he was behind the shed. That sudsing sound was maddeningly loud back here. I'm right behind those goddamn showers, he thought. They're floating inches from me. Literally inches. A rustle of weeds. A minute scrape of metal. Gardner felt simultaneously like laughing and screeching. They hadn't had Bobby's key. Someone had just come around to the side of the shed and taken the key Gardner had hung up again only seconds before. Probably Bobby herself. Still warm from my hand, Bobby, did you notice? He stood in back of the shed, pressed against the rough wood, arms slightly spread, palms tight on the boards. Did you notice? And do you hear me? Do any of you hear me? Is someone, Allison or Archimborg or Beringer, going to suddenly pop his head around here and yell out, "Peekaboo, guard, we see you." Is the shield still working? He stood there and waited for them to take him. They didn't. On an ordinary summer night, he probably would not have been able to hear the metallic rattle as the door was unlocked. It would have been masked by the loud ree, ree, ree of the crickets. But now there were no crickets. He heard the unlocking, heard the creak of the hinges as the door was opened, heard the hinges creak again as the door was pushed shut. They were inside. Almost at once, the pulses of light falling through the cracks began to speed up and become brighter, and his mind was split by an agonized scream.
"Hurts! It hurts!"
He moved away from the shed and went back to the house. 9. He lay awake a long time, waiting for them to come out again, waiting to see if he had been discovered. All right, I can try to put a stop to the becoming, he thought, but it won't work unless I actually can go inside the ship. Can I do that? He didn't know. Bobby seemed to have no worries, but Bobby and the others were different now. Oh, he himself was also becoming. The lost teeth proved that. The ability to hear thoughts did, too. He had changed the words on the computer screen just by thinking them. But there was no use kidding himself. He was far behind the competition. If Bobby survived the entry into the ship and her old buddy guard dropped dead, would any of them, even Bobby herself, spare a tear? He didn't think so. Maybe that's what they all want, Bobby included. For you to go into the ship and just fall over with your brains exploding in one big harmonic radio transmission. It would save Bobby the moral pain of taking care of you herself, for one thing. Murder without tears. That they intended to get rid of him, he no longer doubted. But he thought that maybe Bobby, the old Bobby, would let him live long enough to see the interior of the strange thing they had worked so long to dig up. That, at least, felt right. And in the end, it didn't matter. If murder was what Bobby was planning, there was no real defense, was there? He had to go into the ship. Unless he did that, his idea, crazy as it undoubtedly was, had no chance to work at all. Have to try, guard. He had intended to try as soon as they were inside, and that would probably be tomorrow morning. Now he thought that maybe he ought to press his luck a little further. If he went according to the rag and a bone he supposed he had to call his original plan, there would be no way he could do anything about that little boy. The kid would have to come first. Guard, he's probably dead anyway. Maybe, but the old man didn't think so. The old man thought there was still a little boy left to save.
One kid doesn't matter. Not in the face of all this. You know it, too. Haven is like a great big nuclear reactor that's ready to go redline. The containment is melting, to coin a phrase.
It was logical, but it was Croupier's logic. Ultimately, killer logic. Ted the Power Man logic. If he wanted to play the game that way, why even bother?
The kid matters, or nothing matters.
And maybe this way, he could even save Bobby. He didn't think so. He thought Bobby had gone too far for salvation. But he could try.
Long odds, guard, old guard.
Sure. The clock said a minute to midnight. We're down to counting seconds. Thinking that, he slipped into the blankness of sleep. This was followed by nightmares, where he floated in a clear green bath, tethered by thick coaxial cables. He was trying to scream, but he couldn't, because the cables were coming out of his mouth.